To me, agency is kind of a fancy word, but the reality is behind it is a sense of humanity, dignity, being, and authenticity.
At Home with Growing Older is a nonprofit organization which believes in peer learning and creating discussions which bring the lens of aging to a variety of topics. At Home with Growing Older is proud to be your host of At Home on Air, a radio hour offering connection, community, and knowledge to our participants remotely. Now, we invite you to listen and learn from this live recorded episode of At Home on Air.
Welcome, everybody, to a very special episode of At Home on Air. I'm Susie Stadler, the executive director of At Home with Growing Older and also the producer of this podcast. At Home on Air is a forum to explore the work it takes to be at home with growing older, but also the delight which comes with it. And an opportunity to thank our guests, our many guests who have shared their professional and personal insights in this exploration over the last 49 episodes. We are celebrating the 50th episode with a very esteemed and wonderful guest with the best background ever, Jenny Chin Hansen, a community builder, advocate, and activist for the well-being and health of old adults in our communities. She's well known for her achievements with the PACE program, integrating social and medical care for old adults, and she continues to get stuff done. Managing her own aging experience so she can serve those who come after us, and fighting ageism as a barrier to innovative thinking. And as I just learned, she continues to get accolades and awards. And last year, she got, as the first nurse, an honorary doctorate from Harvard. Amazing. Welcome, Jenny. Thank you for joining us and helping us mark our milestone, our 50th podcast.
Well, thank you, Susie. This is indeed just a pleasure and an honor. And to the audience, Susie and I had a chance to have a rolling conversation in preparation for this. And so please know this is very organic and the ability to have questions from you is great. I am honored without a question to do this with Susie since I've been involved in her work. The architect of Susie has shown her love and respect and creativity for design and the work that has shown up in so many different places. So just a pleasure to be with you all because I know some of you rather well and know that you have your respective bodies of work that have contributed to our field of humanity and decency and well-being for all of us. So a pleasure to be with you here.
Thank you, Jenny. Before we start this thought-provoking conversation, I'd encourage you to really check out the amazing archive of the past 49 conversations on our website. I think you will find many rich and wonderful inspirations there. A little bit about the title, Coming Out as an Older Adult. It's a quote from one of our Aging 360 workshop participants at the Cadillac Hotel, an SRO in the San Francisco Tenderloin. We now have facilitated there for the last 3 years. When this participant was asked what she had taken away from the workshop, she said that it made her feel more comfortable coming out as an older person. And it really struck me, and I think also Jenny, that this meant she had built the confidence to talk and share the good and the bad of her aging experience. She feels that she has agency in making changes and agency in being an advocate for herself. This was an inspiration for us. So Jenny, how do you practice living with agency? I know that agency is a very important word for you. And also, how do you foster collective agency.
Well, thank you, Susie, for starting us off in this way, and especially the story behind the title. You know, I hope people realize it's meant to be respectful, given all the other ways that we have talked about how people come out. But coming out is about agency, is feeling comfortable and owning who we are. And probably the sentinel event that led me to feel about agency, and that was when I was a teenager. I used to work at a Chinese restaurant in the outer Boston area. I grew up in Boston's Chinatown. And most of the men who worked in the restaurants didn't have their own car. So there's one place that people centrally would locate every morning, and people would have coffee, and then the cars would all split up with their respective workers and head out to the suburbs to work for the day. I worked there on weekends in summer, so I got a ride as well. So I happened to be riding in a car, two in the front seat and three of us in the back seat. My father was next to me, I was in the middle, and there was someone else. And as we drove to our suburb, we stopped at one light, and there were a couple of African-American individuals who walked by. And the front seat, two people started making some comments, and they were disparaging. They were about, you know, how food might be prepared for people who are African-American because they like salt, so we always put more salt. I was shocked, frankly, that they would say that. So I said something. It was just spontaneous, and I noted that this is what they were saying about a segment of people with that generalization. And I reminded them that we too, all five of us, were minorities. I pointed out that this was very disrespectful. Here I am, a teenager, and my father sitting with me. And my father didn't react. And I was noting that. Even in the course of going into the restaurant and the rest of the day, my father never said anything about that event. And I was aware that he allowed me to be who I am, and he didn't edit me or censor me in any particular way. It's feeling accepted, feeling visible, and being able to say the truth. And that probably started my journey. And I ended up doing these kinds of conversations over the course of my decades. To me, agency is kind of a fancy word, but the reality is behind it is a sense of humanity, dignity, being, and authenticity. I find that that genuine aspect helps for probably one's mental health as well, because you don't have to be one person so different in another. You may have contextual caution, but you don't have to disengage with who you genuinely are. And I think when we can do that, we can age as well. During our teen years, I had a little makeup on and stuff like that. My father said to me, "You don't need makeup." And it was one of those comments. It wasn't saying you can't wear makeup, you shouldn't wear makeup. It was, you don't really need makeup. And it was just like, wow, oh, okay, you know. And I've never been a major makeup person. But these are little episodes that I think shape us. And the ability to come out as an older person is that I continue to evolve as an older person. I just feel very deeply grateful that some of these early childhood experiences have allowed me to be in myself and present externally as well.
Jenny, you mentioned being visible, and sometimes this gets more difficult. As an older adult, you become invisible. In a way, it takes more courage to actually stay visible. And I wonder if this resonates with you. You're very well known, so it probably doesn't happen to you, but I wonder if you have come across this working with so many older adults in your career.
Oh, most certainly. I probably had the sensitivity to visibility also from an early childhood experience. When I was a Girl Scout, during Thanksgiving, we would go to visit nursing homes, and we'd bring our turkey, and we were in our uniforms and everything. And I happened to sit down next to this older person, and all she wanted to do was to hold my hand. It wasn't because we were there with turkeys and the fact that it was nice to have a whole bunch of girls in green walking around. I felt that she just had the need to be personally connected to me, and she held my hand and looked in my eyes. It stopped me from talking about any turkeys or anything, but I just realized, oh my gosh, this is just something different. And the fact that she felt that she could touch, and I could tell, I could feel how much it meant to her. So this ability to honor a person with who they are. And I've had several experiences over that. And during that growing up process, I mean, the word visibility wasn't in the vernacular that we used at the time, but it was just the fact that when people were spoken with and to and together, they warmed up. Because I am a visible, racial, different person, I have been invisible for that reason as well. There are other things that cause invisibility. People who feel that they have a lot of power and are very boisterous, they try to create the fact that you are not as worthy or not as worth their time for that. So I think we go through invisibility at different points in different contexts. And so we all have that. I had an exchange professionally recently about visibility. I mentioned that sometimes being less visible is actually okay because you're under the radar. My PACE work was a good example. It was so fundamentally different what was going on. You almost didn't want people to know a lot about it at the time because the pushback happens right away. Sometimes you can do work under the radar and get much more done when people aren't, focused on you. So it's an interesting concept to sometimes be okay with invisibility because it gives you a buffer. Again, we're all subject to interpreting what it means, but sometimes I was glad that I could lay low.
So, when you are under the radar, you sometimes can do good work because people, don't notice you. I feel like this is also when you talk about that as old adults, we have an obligation to the generations who come after us. And I think that's also an opportunity at this time in life when you may be a little bit under the radar to support people who come after us. And you do this in many ways. And I wonder if you can share this a little bit.
Sure, I'll talk professionally as well as personally. I think the ability to find ourselves in a position not to be the doer, but the catalyst as well as the supporter for people who are coming along the way. So it's not about telling people, it's about listening to what the needs might be and the opportunity to hear it either directly or to clarify if what you're sensing is true. So this whole idea of the old teachers talking and imparting information down to people versus this newer movement of co-design, delivering and listening and shaping, whether it's the product or the conversation, that is much more collaborative. But the whole aspect of design in today's day is just more humanistic. It's just not like the expert. And you being an architect, you have the idea in your mind, and this is what you're going to deliver. You understand what the context is, what the person wants, what they hope for, and together you shape something. So that's part of being helpful now. There's not as much telling as there is listening, collaborating, and co-designing. Then I have a personal example. My granddaughter is now 14. And I can remember family went out to dinner, and I happened to turn around and I saw that her eyelashes were curled. And I had never seen that before. I spontaneously said, Ella, are your eyelashes curled? And of course, she just got flustered with that, as many teenagers do when they get called for what you happen to observe. But I realized it made her very uncomfortable. And so after that, I have never said anything else about her makeup. It's learning to help the relationship. There's a help the relationship be better. And that's what drives me. rather than the fact that I pass judgment. And not that I may not have internal judgment, but part of it is knowing when to zip it up and be able to make sure that we're hearing things. Because only as we get to know people more do we understand what we see and have a much more sensitive context of that interaction that we're having.
So, Jenny, your work with people who are your junior, both age-wise and maybe also professionally, is so enriching because it gives you a new lens, but also it sort of builds new muscles. And not everybody has this opportunity to build new muscle. I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more about how to build this new muscles as we grow older, or share some personal experience about that.
I'll start with the metaphor. I think we all have both the basic muscles and the potential for new muscle growth. The point being that we tend to operate in a zone that we're comfortable with. And so often we tend to, for the most part, have quite a bit of exposure to our age peers. Over time, we have much more of the mix. And so as I've become an older person, I learned from some of my chronologically younger colleagues who know some skills and knowledge that I don't, the ability to allow the openness and flexibility to learn and ask for help for somebody who might be 30 years younger than you, but they have knowledge and skills that we don't. As we learn from them, I think we have a chance to build different muscles that we never had before, and they're a lot smaller. Their muscle in that domain is a lot bigger. It's not a matter of power equation as much. Ideally, when we do it well, we synchronize and we can move a lot faster together when our muscles are moving in a collegial way. But it's because somebody else brings a different item to the recipe. And when we put it all together with the right parameters, it's a lot better. When it's joyful and great that you can feel vulnerable to say, could you help set up this spreadsheet for me that I don't happen to know how to do? I think it gives them pleasure, the fact that they can have a role and are useful as well. And so there are other things that I might be able to share. So their sense of interdependence. We have this machismo about independence. And the reality is, we're social beings. And when we can see that we can be vulnerable as well as strong, it's just a lot more fun and it's a lot easier too. There's a smoothness that can evolve rather than one is the master or mistress all the time and one is the learner. When we have the flexibility to be open-minded, that sometimes we know more things, and sometimes the other person will know more things, and it's okay. We're not lesser for it. We just, frankly, have a different background.
You also talked about that you enjoy more the intimate setting and not the 1,000 people conferences. That's much more stimulating for you. We talked about this also in the context that it becomes more work to be socially engaged as you get older and to be out and about. You are able to sort of harness this as a positive aspect.
Well, I've done some of these personality tests, as some of us have done, and it turns out I actually am an introvert, but my work has caused me to be very public. I can do that. As my husband used to say, I'll work the tables at a banquet when I was the chief executive of a not-for-profit. Fundraising time, I'd go from table to table and all this. And so the nature of my work called me to be very publicly visible. But personally, I am an introvert. So one of the things I used to do to survive is that I do these things from breakfast meetings to dinners and stuff. But when I could, if I had a night off, I'd go back to my hotel room and get room service. And I would reintegrate and frankly get some more energy. And because of the pandemic, we all got shut off from stuff. And somebody asked how I was, and I was almost embarrassed to have to admit, it was actually okay. I didn't have to travel so much, and I didn't have to go to these meetings. Just 2 months ago, went to the International Alzheimer's Association meeting. There were 8,000 people there. I mean, I was just totally blown away. It was very intellectually stimulating, and I met some old colleagues as well as made some new acquaintances. It was very enriching, but I was wiped out. I was just totally, totally wiped out. So it just depends. Nowadays, in my aging factor, I don't work for an organization right now. I am quite involved with boards and activities, but I don't have to see tons of people every day. And I'm on Zoom a fair amount for my life. And I find that's okay. I do have more intimate work groups that I may be a part of, but that's enough for me now. It's just like I am not hankering to go to these annual big conferences. I tend to avoid those meetings where I can right now. I just find that it's more productive for me to have smaller conversations, ideally in person. I had to go for a meeting back east for like a day. My granddaughter said to me, "Why don't you just do Zoom?" For those of us who are accustomed, there is something fundamentally quite different when we meet in person. And so there is a role for that. And then there's a role for these two-dimensional interactions that we have over the screen. I think this sense of intimacy is my preference right now, to have dialogues of smaller sizes.
Yeah, and I think you're not the only one. I think that's sort of part of growing older, and there's a fine line between, enjoying this intimacy and becoming lonely for many people. I want to understand a little bit more your work. I'm not sure the name fighting ageism is actually correct. It's more that you perceive ageism as a barrier to innovative thinking, which is a really interesting approach to it. And I wonder how this perspective or approach actually colors the way you go about counteracting ageism.
Yeah. Well, I have some wonderful colleagues who are really out there fighting ageism. They are well known and extremely effective with wise messages as well as assertive messages. But that goes with the personalities they are as well. I mean, they are activists in that kind of visible way. And I have posted certainly on things about aging, but on the scale of, say, one of my good friends who wrote This Chair Rocks, Ashton Applewhite, who some of you know, is hugely effective in her ability to articulate. She's written this fantastic book, as I said, This Chair Rocks, and she has that kind of fighting, feisty spirit. And we need good people like her. But some of us aren't quite built that way, And so there are other things, reframing the age by what we say and what we can do. I find that is my means, with my gray hair, people instantly kind of accord me sometimes, oh, the wisdom. And I'm thinking, I'm not wise. But how we use that opening shows, frankly, the contemporary thoughts that we have, the interdependence knowledge, and even the content knowledge, or putting context in a way of not saying, oh, we used to do that, in a way that is a little bit uppity, or we tried that already type of thing in terms of being somewhat dismissive of somebody. But if we aren't and we're listening and we're building on, building with, it shows that people of all ages have something to contribute. So I think it's by our behavior, and others of us are helping to clear the brush with that kind of loud activism. So I think we just have a way of doing it in different manners. But ultimately, she's looking for dignity. She's looking for that kind of respect. When we do it a quieted way, we also show that there is dignity in the thinking process, and that when we have context of having done it, we are able to kind of interdigitate with today's circumstances, but not just refer to what it was like 40 years ago as a de facto. There are just different ways to be able to show you can interdigitate, you can filter, you can understand context, and you really are hearing what that point is that's being offered.
What I also hear is don't let ageism get in the way of you doing the work.
I think of a lot of our Black civil rights history. of how much people had to go through when any kind of ism of that nature starts. And there are incredible stories of the strength of people who were able to achieve, what people did during internment in terms of still, quotes, producing something that was proactive. I think there are times where many of us will feel that, will suffer under it, but part of it is never to let go of the spirit of possible. And some people have to deal with it for a long time or their entire lifetime, but they still move ahead. Sometimes you just don't say stuff, and other people may choose a different way to express it. But I just have found that to be able to have that kind of variability, flexibility, and understanding the circumstance as to that part of your agency that will show up.
And that's part of the delight of being an older adult, that you actually have the life experience.
It's not kind of like a badge to wave. It's a circumstance of fact. But how we deal with what we are, what we happen to have at that moment, is a choice. And that's something is I think the ability to have the growth in discernment and timing and how you express your ethics at a given time.
Yeah, thanks for adding this.
You are listening to At Home On Air. We are now switching to questions by participating audience members in this recorded live episode. If you want a chance to ask your question, visit us at athomewithgrowingolder.org and register for the next live episode.
So John Milford says, coming out as an older person is the brilliant antidote to human nature's tendency for life stage denial.
Thank you. Well said.
Mikiko Huang says, design with us, not for us, as Dr. June Fisher used to say. And may June's memory be a blessing. That's very true. She was a wonderful activist. Andrea asks, I am curious what kind of criticism or lack of support you were referring to when you said it was helpful to be less visible when you worked in the PACE program.
Well, it's interesting because the PACE program started here in San Francisco with an organization by the name of Onlock Senior Health Services. It was based in the northeast part of San Francisco. The residents were primarily Chinese, Italians, and Filipinos at that point in history. We're talking about 55 years ago. And the organization had a very strong predominance of Chinese staff and clients. And so as we were developing the idea of what this integrated program would be, people saw the optics of immigrants. These were immigrant Chinese, immigrant Italians, people who spoke only their native language. So people just cast this stereotype that, oh, this works because this is an immigrant community. That was kind of the label. They would see us physically, visibly being Chinese or an Italian elder who only spoke Italian. There was just kind of a quick judgment as to what this was. The fact that they almost kind of dismissed us, that this was just a sweet little community program. While at the same time, under the radar, we were looking at the financing structure, the Medicare policies, what the data was, and understanding the finances. So this invisibility of kind of being dismissed, frankly, allowed us the freedom to do some of this innovation that nobody seemed to care about because they didn't think that it had any, big time value. We were kind of lucky that way, that we weren't questioned with every little move because we were not important enough. And so sometimes not being important enough allows you a degree of freedom.
Well, little did they know.
Jenny, that honestly was a brilliant business model. And I don't think people picked up on that right away. But federal Medicare realized that they could not pour out the amount of money they were paying for nursing homes. And what Unlock was able to do was to work out a business model that said, if you'll give us an amount of money less than what you're paying for people to be in nursing homes, we can provide them help at home, and there's still enough money to keep the business going. And it worked, and it was brilliant.
I could not have said it better, John. Thank you.
I watched it happen, and I was in awe. I was opening San Francisco Towers for the other end of the economic community. Watching what was happening, I just admired it so much. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Yes, we were working hard with data. This was a kind program, a respectful program, but we were looking at the hard numbers. We were looking at legal policies. We suffered. Here's an example of what we did. We had a 92-year-old lady living in one of these SROs, these single-room occupant rooms. She had broken her hip. She was in the hospital. Standard hospitalization stays in terms of what was normal at the time was 7 days. We had discharged her 3.5 days in, and people instantly reacted that we were stinting on care. But what we had instead is that we had her home already set up. The physical therapist had gone in, brought in equipment. We had a home care worker ready to go. We had medications upon discharge that she was having. So she was able to leave the hospital, not because we were shorting her on a hospital stay, but we knew that her natural environment was going to be much better. She had her own food that she liked. She wasn't exposed to infections. She didn't get delirium. She was able to practice on her own stairs. Her outcome was that she started walking a lot faster than what, quotes, the standard 7 day stay is. The doctors of the community thought we were just terrible because we basically cheated her on 3.5 days of stay in the hospital. But we were looking at her total well-being and her function, and she did so much better because it was about her quality of living, her safety, her function, and the fact that she didn't go delirious while she was in a fairly long stay in a hospital. You have to take those kind of risks because, again, we're being accountable, but accountable in a different way.
Well, it was an innovative model, which now is supported by Medicaid and Medicare, which is pretty amazing.
The PACE program now operates in 34 states and Washington, D.C. I just came from a meeting less than a week ago about further scaling, because there are 85,000 people now. The goal in the next few years is 200,000. So there's work underfoot.
Thank you. That was an important add-on to this lovely conversation. And congratulations on the impact you have made and continue to make in the lives of old adults in this country. Yasmin says, I'm really encouraged by the clubhouse model for a community in mental health, non-hierarchically wisdom work sharing. Can you comment on this in your experience? Are you familiar with this?
Actually, not directly, but I can speak to something else I'm working with now. But would you describe the clubhouse model for us? That would be great.
Actually, it's my daughter up in Montreal just started working with, and she described it as a clubhouse. And so it's not just older people, but it's people that are, you know, needing a place to go during the day. It's only open during the day, and the workers share the work. It's food preparing, some gardening. It's very simple, but it seems to be very, very practical and helpful in ways that you're describing on lock back then.
Yeah, I think the normalization, the more we can see the needs are placed in an environment that allows the normalization as well as their needs to kind of synchronize. I have an example right now. I'm on the board of HelpAge USA that's connected to HelpAge International. And we, HelpAge USA, have brought a model from Zimbabwe where the country had 4 psychiatrists for the entire country, and the lack of mental health services was there. And so this psychiatrist, Dr. Dixon Chibabwe, has actually created what turned out to be called a friendship bench in the community. It's staffed by grandmothers. It's not just for older people, but all ages. There's a psychiatrist behind it. There's an MSW person qualified behind it. And there's protocols of making sure that when somebody does come to the friendship bench, it's not due to severe mental illness, and that the community resources are there for making sure that the referral system is there. This has ended up working and transported to other countries, but HelpAge USA has worked with Dr. Zimbabwe and being able to have a formal contract so that we train our grandmothers. And now we have 10 sites in Washington, D.C. But yeah, the ability to normalize this, sitting on a bench. I'm at a stage of my life that I'm not working for a professional organization. I would love to see care and human contact available and affordable, and that we can mobilize talents that we don't normally use. I mean, these grandmothers are kick butt people in terms of their capability because they go through 12-week training. This is not like, you know, put out a bench and that's it. But their agency has been phenomenal. They've been on CBS. They've been on Sunday morning programs now to do this. And I love this because it's not a high cost program, but it's like using your judgment of gratification and best use. And all these grandmothers, I think there are now some men who are part of the team, who are able to have the warmth of listening and not giving advice. They really are trained not to be giving advice, but to be, what's that phrase of interviewing? It's listening deeply.
Appreciative inquiry.
Yes, yes, thank you. So bottom line, the ability to do this in a more natural type of way that you don't have to wait for a nurse practitioner who's mental health trained or a psychiatrist, because they're so hard to get a hold of, which is why I know telemental health has really grown. I think the point of the clubhouse model is just dialing it back down. Not everything is a diagnosis with a code that you have to bill for. We could mobilize us as resources and people who may have time. And so we have many of these retired grandmothers who had formal professional roles, but they found that this has been so fulfilling for them. And so we hope to continue to scale this. But there are 10 sites now in Washington, D.C., in high-risk districts.
That's a fabulous story, and it makes so much sense, you know, because it's really community-based and it's easy to access, and the threshold is much lower than, you know, talking to a nurse practitioner or a doctor. This also relates to Candice's question, how do you fund this kind of programs? Because aging is not sexy. Any suggestions to get attention of people and say, this is what we need? You have done this with Unlock and PACE.
Yeah, it's never easy. And for about 20 years, literally, the funding for aging was 1% of foundation grants. Now, they've increased it by 100%, but now that's 2%. It hasn't gone up appreciably. And I've actually worked with a foundation here in San Francisco on a project. They are finished with it now, but they invested in it for 10 years. There's nobody else really gearing up. So there is ageism. I mean, this is a reflection of that. And so the question of getting the attention of the funders do know about it. One of the things that I have been conveying, when there is intergenerational work, it may actually be more palatable, if not of interest to people, to do this. So there are some more intergenerational efforts now, which is a strength to itself. For a more focused self-interest, all these hospitals that operate have to do a community benefit fund. It's frankly demographics that might be of their interest to pay more attention to that. You know, just seeing if you can focus on some of what they come out with. Because every 3 years, they're legally required to do a community survey to help develop the knowledge as to what kind of services are needed. Inevitably, they're always aging services. So those are places where they have to do something, whether they do it in aging or not, but calling to accountability how they spend their money might elevate that.
Yes, and it makes a lot of sense that hospitals would be really interested in nurturing community health. It really benefits them.
Yeah, I think if we could stop medicalizing everything, you know, and having to have a billing code for us to do anything, we have to get back to normal baseline. And I think there's so much to be learned in communities and countries that don't have resources and the ability to do reverse learning. And that our example of the friendship bench comes from Zimbabwe, that there is more to learn about, quotes, normalizing and doing some mitigation and prevention earlier on. And Dr. Rick Moody has written much about this, actually for his whole career. He is an applied philosopher, and he's recently produced another book. You should go on LinkedIn and check him out. There are ways to think about it and not get sucked in automatically to the clinical issues, because aging is much bigger and the opportunities are much more, how should I say it, Rick, what is that? You're the one with the publications here.
The less said, the better. Those who speak do not know. Those who know do not speak.
Well, I think that's part of the normalization. And Yasmin, I'll turn to you.
I just wanted to say that the reason I mentioned the clubhouse that my daughter is working at in Montreal, she was trained to be a facilitator, and it's an intergenerational model. And I'll say that for her mental health, it has been unbelievable to be in that position of helping and interdependence. And so she thought she was going in for a job, and it has really been such a balm for her.
Yeah, just as this friendship bench. I mean, there's all the grandmothers are literal volunteers and all this. They have expressed what difference it has made in their life of purpose and meaning and being part of a community. So I think we have to spend a little more energy back there. I feel blessed that I have had a strong clinical background. I know the medical system. I know policy and payments. But what gives me the joy now is how do we make this much more available? And not everything has to go through a randomized controlled trial, you know, to be effective. And so that's why I think sometimes learning from other countries that have been able to do this. But if we could mitigate this isolation and loneliness that people have and have a sense of interconnectivity, I think it would make such a bigger difference that people aren't just away and counting the hours. Our ability to just have people connected, sharing meals together, getting together three or four people who switch off on cooking a meal a night. There are things that we can just do that are about people. Connectivity to start with is just real important. And I know that many of the senior centers that operate in our communities have been going through a reinvention of themselves in terms of trying to have a different kind of set of activities for meaningfulness, so that even though people may enjoy bingo and find a great deal of pleasure, that may be there. But is there some other way to help define gathering places for older people?
Jenny, I think that's closing the loop, what you would call nurturing collective agency. And I feel like we are also lucky to do this programming, which connect and engage people. That's what we do with our Aging 360 workshop, where people really engage with making changes to their homes, just small improvements, and they do this together. And that's where also this quote came from, which gave us the title for this conversation. What actually starts when people start talking to each other and when we can build a space of trust where this happens? I just wanted to thank you that you built the space of trust for us and you continue to build it for many other people. So I really want to thank you for this free-flowing conversation. So thank you, Jenny, and thank you for celebrating with us. And thank you, everybody, for being here.
Thank you for the privilege, Susie.
This episode of At Home On Air was produced by the At Home with Growing Older team. We could not host these conversations without the generosity of our marvelous and passionate guests and hosts. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional insights. Thank you to our live audience for your thoughtful contributions. To subscribe to this podcast and for more information, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org. At Home with Growing Older strives to educate, inspire, and connect people across generations and disciplines to re-envision and improve the experiences of later life. Don't forget to subscribe and tune in for the next episode.